So this morning we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Leela, chapter 18, and we're starting with text number 135. Who's good at Bengali? Hands up, come on, don't be shy. You actually good at Bengali? You lived in Bengal. Do you want to chant the verse?
No.
He speaks Bengali, then Maharaj will do it.
Ekadina
seya krura gatera upare.
Ekadina
seya krura
gatera
upare.
Ekadina seya krura gatera upare.
Vasi mahaprabhu kichu karina vichare.
Translation of purport by Srila Prabhupada. One day Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sat at the bathing ghat of a Krura Tirtha and thought the following thoughts. Purport. Jai Radha Gopinath. Krura Tirtha is located on the road between Vrindavan and Mayapur. When Krishna and Balaram were taken to Mathura by Akrura, the Lord rested at this place and took his bath in the Yamuna. When Krishna and Balaram took their baths, Akrura saw the entire world of Vaikuntha within the water. The inhabitants of Vrindavan also saw the Vaikuntha planets within the water. And I'll just read the texts. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught, at this place, Akrura saw Vaikuntha, the spiritual world, and all the inhabitants of Raj, Sogoloka, Vrindavan. While considering how Akrura remained within the water, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu immediately jumped in and stayed under the water for some time. When Krishnadas saw that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was drowning, he cried and shouted very loudly. Balabhadra Bhattacharya immediately came and pulled the Lord out. We're very thankful to Balabhadra Bhattacharya. After this, Balabhadra Bhattacharya took the Sanodiya Brahman to a secluded place and consulted with him. Balabhadra Bhattacharya said, since I was present today, it was possible for me to pull the Lord up. However, if he starts to drown at Vrindavan, who will help him? Now there is a crowd of people here, and these invitations are causing much disturbance. In addition, the Lord is always ecstatic and emotional. I do not find the situation here very good. It would be good if we could get Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu out of Vrindavan. That is my final conclusion. So it's a health and safety issue. The Sanadiya Brahman said, let us take him to Prayag and along the banks of the Ganges. It will be very pleasurable to go that way. After going to the holy place named Saro Shetra and taking bath in the Ganges, let us take Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that way and go. It is now the beginning of the month of Magha. If we go to Prayag at this time, we shall have the opportunity to bathe for a few days during Makara Sankranti. Oh yes, Makara Sankranti. There's a purport here. Bathing during the month of Magha at Magha Mela still takes place. This has been a very old Mela assembly for since time immemorial. It is said that the Lord in the form of Mohini took a bucket of nectar and kept it at Prayag. This is nectar from the churning of the ocean. Consequently, Magha Mela has been observed, and there is an assembly of holy men there every year. Every 12th year, there is a Kumbh Mela, a great festival, and all the holy men from all over India assemble there. The Brahman wanted to take advantage of the Magha Mela and bathe there. Bathing at the confluence of the Ganges and Yamuna near the fort at Allahabad, Prayag, is mentioned in revealed scriptures, and it's quoted, if one goes to Prayag and bathes at the confluence of the Ganges and Yamuna in the month of Magha, he attains the result of giving hundreds and thousands of cows in charity. Simply by bathing for 3 days there, he attains the results of such a pious activity. End of quote. Because of this, the Sanadiya Brahman was very eager to go to Prayag and bathe. Generally, karmis, fruit of laborers, take advantage of bathing there during the month of Magha, thinking that they will be rewarded in the future. Those who are situated in devotional service do not very strictly follow this karmakandiya process. Interesting. Next text. The Sanadiya Brahman continued, kindly submit to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu the unhappiness you are feeling within yourself. Then propose that we all go to Prayag on the full moon day in the month of Magha. Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Bhattacharyaji is concerned. Health and safety issues. Lord Chaitanya keeps on falling into the river and looks like he's going to drown someday if no one's about. So he's saying, I think we should get him out of this place. And the Sanadiya Brahman is thinking, I want to go to Prayag. Look at the month. Let me go to Prayag and get some benefits. I tell you what, why don't we go to... You convince Chaitanya to go to Prayag. Let's do that then. So, it's interesting, isn't it, all this politics going on, even in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Tell the Lord of the happiness you will feel in travelling via the banks of the Ganges. Balabhadracharya therefore submitted his prayer to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Balabhadra Bhattacharya said to the Lord, I can no longer tolerate the disturbance of the crowd. People are coming one after another to offer invitations. Early in the morning people come here, and not seeing you present, they simply tax my brain. I will be very happy if we all leave and take the path by the banks of the Ganges, and then we can have the opportunity to bathe in the Ganges in Prayag during Makara Sankranti. Purport. There are two great occasions for bathing in the Ganges during Magha Mela. One is on the day of the dark moon and the other is on the day of the full moon during the month of Magha. My mind has become very agitated. I cannot bear this anxiety. May everything rest on the permission of your lordship. I will accept whatever you want to do. Although Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had no desire to leave Vrindavan, he began to speak sweet words just to fulfill the desire of his devotee. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, you have brought me here to show me Vrindavan. I am very much indebted to you, and I shall not be able to repay this debt. Whatever you desire, I must do. Wherever you take me, I shall go. The next morning, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu got up early. After taking his bath, he became ecstatic with love, knowing he now had to leave Vrindavan. Although the Lord did not exhibit any external symptoms, his mind was filled with ecstatic love. At that time, Balabhadra said, let us go to Mahavan, Gokula. We'll stop there. If someone wants to take a notice, 156. I went a little bit over my quota, but that's life. Omaginati Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshura Miratamyana Tasmai Sri Kuravenama Sri Chaitanya Manobishtamas the Pitamina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapanantikam. Krishna. It's a very nice little story, and it continues to be a very nice little story. But it's interesting that the Chaitanya Charitamrita is all about, it's all about love of God, and it's all about the devotees associating with each other. And this is why Prabhupada says this is the highest literature, and we have to study Bhagavad Purana, the Srimad Bhagavatam, first. Because without the philosophical perspective of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we actually can't understand the loving pastimes, the relationships that these people have. And it's interesting that the essence of Chaitanya Charitamrita is relationship. It's such a profound concept within our tradition. And it's exhibited here very nicely, because although we see Lord Chaitanya as an incarnation of Krishna and Radharani combined, such an elevated theological concept, very difficult for us to even understand. And this is about his pastimes. And in the middle, we find all these little instances of what we might call real life. It's like where the heavenly mind that hits the earth. So he's being manipulated, essentially. And the person behind the manipulation is the Brahman, who is essentially a karmakandiya. He wants to go to Prayag to get some punya, some piety. So he wants to perform his service and get some result. So I do a little bit for Krishna, I get a little bit back. So it's a business thing going on. So that's not the love of God that Lord Chaitanya stands for. Yet in this instance, he doesn't want to leave Vrindavan, yet he wants to satisfy his devotee, Balabhadra Bhattacharya. So he says, okay, let's go. He just surrenders to it. And it's very interesting. If I analyze myself in a similar situation, and I feel for any instance that I'm being manipulated by somebody, my reaction is a little bit more, I don't know,
firm.
You know, you just don't want to be manipulated. I don't want to feel manipulated. It makes me feel, it offends my self-esteem. It rocks my self-confidence. How dare you, sir, suggest that I should follow your agenda, which is just a karmi agenda. This is just a fruitive agenda. I could righteously stand on this asan and talk right down to that person, and I would be talking pure Krishna consciousness. But would I be talking in a Krishna conscious way? And that's the kind of hint that we get from this kind of story. Lord Chaitanya isn't interested in politics to the extent that he actually doesn't engage. He doesn't fear being manipulated because he can't be manipulated, because his ecstasy is within. Nobody can take it away. His service to Krishna is his own. It's nobody else's. He made the choice that I will become a servant of Krishna. So historically we can say, oh, he didn't make a choice, he's God. But he came and gave us the example that he was a Nyaya scholar. This Nyaya school of scholarship in Navadvipa was very famous. This was one of the big universities of India. And he was one of the good Nyaya scholars. This is followers of logic. This is not bhakti. This is a different process. So this was his field of study. And he wasn't exactly satisfied, but who's satisfied? Who's happy? He just got on with it. Became a householder. But when he met his spiritual master, Ishvara Puri, he transformed utterly. He accepted bhakti into his heart completely and transformed completely. And came back a completely different person. And he accepted. So he made a choice. He said, oh, I have met you. You have given me this gift. Thank you very much. I choose this gift over this Nyaya. I leave that behind. Now I will go back and teach something else. I will be a completely different person. So that choice was made in his life. He became a devotee. And from that point on, I will show pure devotional service in practice. That's my job. He accepted that as his service. And he's showing us, when we talk about humility in our tradition, this is the level of humility we're discussing. Lord Chaitanya said, Trinada Pi Sunichina, and we know that text that is the exemplar of humility, more tolerant than a tree, humbler than the blade of grass, ready to offer all respect unto others and expect none for ourselves. That is the crucial hint right there. Ready to offer all respect to others. So he's in a situation where what we could term as an disrespectful person or a person who doesn't deserve respect is coming asking for respect. Respect my wish to go to Prayag. Someone who's being manipulated by someone else, we could say that that's a disrespectful thing. But Lord Chaitanya gives it full respect because he wants it. We have the story of the Brahmin the Pandit who comes to challenge Sanatan Goswami and Jiva and Rupa Goswami, and he's got his tally stick of all the different Brahmins that he's defeated, and he wants a certificate to say, I've defeated these Goswamis in Vrindavan. They're worthy of, if I defeat them, my prestige rises. He wanted respect. That was his aim. So he comes to them, and their aim is to serve Krishna. That's their only interest. They don't care if people think they're thick and not very intelligent and are easily defeated by a passing pundit. That's not their concern in life. Their concern is to serve Krishna, to meditate on Krishna. And in that meditation, go so deep into the meditation that they are with Krishna. That's their concern in life. It's a service concern. So when someone comes up with this other concern, you know, I want to smash you in argument. So what's the easiest thing to do? I mean, how do you discern this person? This person wants respect. So give them respect. Just give it to them. Why argue? And by giving them that respect, so they just signed the document and gave it to him. Now, Jiva Goswami, of course, then, as a disciple and a family relative, he said, oh, okay, come with me. I'll show you respect. But this was their example. This is an extraordinary example. So we have ordinary and we have extraordinary. It's just not the ordinary, it's something a bit special. It's extraordinary. This is not the normal course of events. If someone comes to us and they want respect and we don't think they deserve it, our ego, our false identity, says, smash them. Fight. Fight, strangle, with teeth, arms, legs, headbutts, however it happens, destroy that person because they are unworthy. The ego just responds in a just totally negative way immediately. And this is kind of, in a sense, you could say, this is the normal course, this is the default position. Because we're all afflicted with ego. But the Vaishnava example, why does this politics seep itself into this high theological text? Because it shows us practically, Krishna consciousness is a practical thing. Lord Chaitanya is showing us by his example how you develop Vaishnavism. Rupa and Sanatana are showing by their example, this is preaching. They didn't stop the person and say, okay, preaching, he's challenging me on a point, therefore I will preach to him, and by my preaching I will destroy him, I will smash him, and therefore I am great. They showed by their personal example. Their personal example comes down to us to this day as a powerful act. That powerful act of example is eloquent preaching. More eloquent, possibly, than if they would have just defeated him in argument. But they chose a Vaishnava path to preach, not the usual path. They didn't have to argue intellectually. They had to act like a devotee is supposed to act. And they proved their Vaishnavism by their practice. It's a very powerful point. And Lord Chaitanya makes the same point. And they, of course, claim that they got this from Lord Chaitanya. By his extraordinary example, they got the hint of Krishna consciousness. Oh, look at how a devotee acts. A devotee doesn't involve themselves in the normal course of events. Doesn't get caught up in the politics of the situation. Doesn't have to analyze everyone else's motive. It's not our concern. Lord Chaitanya knew everyone's motive. He could have remedied it in an instance. He could have made some extraordinary form and come down from on high with a big stick and go tip, and the guy would have keeled over. End of story. End of disturbance. He didn't even want to leave Vrindavan, but he wanted to satisfy the devotee. He didn't want disturbance. Because wherever Lord Chaitanya went, we know well, was Vrindavan. He was just absorbed so much in Krishna that Krishna was everywhere. There was no disturbance for him. So he wasn't going to create an extra disturbance in someone else's life. He wasn't going to shake someone else's tree just because he could. This is a very important example for us in our preaching. Because when we approach preaching, we have to approach it taking the example of our acharyas. What was the mood in which they preached? What principles did they work from? And maybe more importantly, what were their virtues? Now we're hinted at what their virtues are in various places in the Srimad Bhagavatam's Karunaka Tatikshava. These are the qualities of the preacher. So it's tolerance and compassion. And we can also add honesty and humility. Honesty means adherence to truth. It's truthfulness, which is just realizing that I am a very small part of a very big universe. I am a small servant of Krishna. I'm not the big servant, I'm just one servant of Krishna. That's honesty. That leads to automatic humility. And these virtues are what we develop as we practice Krishna consciousness. And we preach from our virtues. That means we preach from our core. We can preach from our intellect. We can become very intelligent, very knowledgeable. We can read all our scriptures and literatures. We can read around that. We can read the Vedas themselves. We can read all Western philosophy and Indian philosophy and Chinese philosophy, and we can defeat everybody soundly. But if it's not done with the proper heart, no one's heart is going to change. Because there's that wonderful text in a passage in the Krishna book where Prabhupada is paraphrasing the Krishna book. He's discussing the flute, how the gopis are hearing Krishna's flute. And the cows hear Krishna's flute. The gopis are saying, look at the cows. And the cow's ears prick up, and she soaks in the liquid nectar of the flute. And she's so satisfied, it's like liquid nectar. It's just, imagine hearing liquid nectar. We know what it's like to drink. So it's like, it's nectar, it's absolutely sweet, beautiful. So getting this beautiful sweetness, and then the calf is there to suck the milk from the mother, but can't because it's stunned by this beautiful sound, and tears are rolling down its eyes. What a beautiful image. And then Prabhupada says, because they're experiencing Krishna heart to heart. This is the essence of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's a relationship heart to heart. And Lord Chaitanya and the devotees are exemplifying how we experience Krishna heart to heart. Not head to head, not mind to mind, not body to body, but heart to heart. It's a much more profound experience. And we know that when we think of what has impressed us in Krishna consciousness, the impressions that are made on us that make us become a devotee, that maintain our devotion, these are issues of the heart. These are things that go very deep. They're not just intellectual arguments. There's some experience that we've had that has changed our heart in some way. These are the issues of Chaitanya Charitamrita. And I think that this is the issue, I mean, maybe one of the many messages we can discern from this story. So I'm looking at the clock, and Manohara has told me what the end time is. So I will stop talking here. If anyone has any questions or comments or humble suggestions, we can discuss further. Well, I suppose the hint is in the concept of Atma. We often talk about Atma from the perspective of I'm not this body. That's the kind of mantra we have. I'm not this body, and that's realization of the self. But that's not actually realization of the self. That's realization of who we're not. So the positive statement of who we are is I am an eternal servant of Krishna. So that's self-realization. That's the ego. Ego, the Greek word ego, means identity. So our identity is I am an eternal servant of Krishna. And is practicing that on a daily basis is realization of Atma. And if we understand that I am an eternal servant of Krishna, that means Krishna loves us eternally. We doubt that. Anyone ever doubted that? Anyone ever felt a bit guilty about something? That we doubt that Krishna loves us because we don't realize who we are. From realizing who we are, only by that realization, by being that person, can we have self-esteem and self-confidence. Because any other person we think we are is a false identity, false ego. And those false egos, you can't have self-confidence with something that isn't yourself. You can't have self-esteem about something that isn't yourself. So these self-esteems are artificial. They have an end date, and the end date is generally with death. And anything that is curtailed by death, we know deep inside, is terminal. It's going to finish. And no matter how much self-esteem we develop about being a temple president, a guru, a swami, a yogi, a professor, a doctor, a head of state, whatever titles we assume, or we get by the good karma or Krishna's grace, they're insignificant because at the time of death, they're curtailed. They mean absolutely nothing. And that helps us understand who we are, reflect. You know, if we think, I'm a grihastha, I'm a brahmachari, I'm a man, I'm a woman, these are false identities, we know that. They're identities that are important in the world. I've tried to convince my wife that I'm not a man, but she just doesn't accept it. So it is part of my identity, part of the Atma. The Atma includes all these things. But my essence, I am an eternal servant of Krishna, no matter what else I think I am. Jai Radha Gopinath. So by meditating on that, then being off the false ego platform, this is a very elevated state. I mean, we glibly say, I'm a servant of Krishna. I am a servant of Krishna. But to be a servant of Krishna, it means self-realization. It means that we are transcendentally realized. It's a very profound practice to practice this in our life, that I am a servant of Krishna. Prabhupada says the gift of Krishna is happiness, distress, fame, infamy, heat and cold, pleasure and pain. Krishna's mercy comes in all these forms. We accept it all. If we're a servant of Krishna, we accept everything without question. Well, you know, I have difficulty sometimes when I have pain. I sometimes struggle with the fact that this is Krishna. I prefer to think it was his fault or some other thing. There's some better explanation that Krishna, then does Krishna really love me? This is love. If we're an eternal servant of Krishna, I'm not the body. It's true. But I can only appreciate I'm not the body from the perspective of who I am. And this is the second chapter of the Gita. Krishna doesn't start, which is obviously a text that advocates surrender and love of God. He doesn't start by saying that. He starts by saying, who are you? Because unless Arjuna realizes who he is, he can't offer his love. We can't freely give our love unless we know who we are to give the love. Who's giving the love? The most fundamental philosophical question in Vedic thought. And it's a very profound question. It's not adequately addressed in any other philosophical system. This basic question, who am I? Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. Right? But he didn't start with who am I? Who's thinking? He didn't answer that question. And this is the basis of enlightenment thinking. We live in a society that is based on enlightenment philosophy. And nobody asked the fundamental question. Lots of zeros, no one. You can look at everyone who's come after him, Kant, Leibniz, Spinoza, whoever you want to come up with. They didn't address the fundamental question. They all respond to the last guy. But no one intelligently asked, let's look at the very big picture. Vedic thinking, coming right from the Rig Veda, is addressing this issue. When we talk about the Vedas, we talk about four texts that look very much like ritualistic texts that we have nothing to do with, essentially Karmakandia. If you've ever read the Rig Veda, that's what it sounds like. And all the other texts, the Atharva Veda, they all sound like that. There's nothing to do. But Bhakti is mentioned there, Dharma is mentioned there, Atma is mentioned there, and Ritta, which is the basis of all our philosophical thinking, is mentioned there. It's very important that we actually understand what Vedic means before we start using the word glibly. And then how it has informed our thinking with regard to Bhakti. And then when you get into Bhakti, you're into a fantastic tradition. I mean, the theology of Bhakti is absolutely incredible. It's world-beating, without doubt. It just beats the pants off everything else. And we don't have to beat the pants off people with a big stick. And we don't have to do it with the big words, intellectual words, and smash them and just sound intelligent and gain more reputation of some kind. We have to do it with our heart. And that's a personal challenge to us. It's a real challenge. For us to preach, we have to practice. And practicing Krishna consciousness is not easy because we're asked to give up our false egos. And for lifetime after lifetime, we've cultivated our false egos assiduously in our little garden. This little cultivation program we have, we're all market gardeners cultivating false ego in the heart. And we're asked by Krishna to go in and cut down all these stalks that we're very proud of. So there are real challenges to us becoming a preacher, which is what our movement is supposed to be about. So humility, realizing that we're not a preacher, just that realization and admitting that realization, even to some you're preaching to, can be more effective preaching than telling them all about Krishna and the gopis, all about you're not the body, and all about the four regulative principles. It can make a much deeper impression on the heart that you can be honest and humble. That these are things we have to consider. So the preaching isn't necessarily obvious. It can be sometimes counterintuitive. It's preaching for us is a very deep concept. It comes directly from Radharani. Her engaging people in Krishna's service, that's our example of preaching. We're here to engage people in Krishna's service. And you will find people will follow a humble person quicker than they'll follow someone who's arrogant or has some pride or has some motivation. We all sense that. One more question before Manohar launch us into a tirade against time wasters. Right.
I have a comment.
Yep.
You mentioned Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's example and also Srila Rupa Goswami's example. But it seems to me that those examples are rather in situations which are simple, relatively. But then when we see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and other examples, just like when he had to deal with King Prasaparudra, series of Although Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood was very soft, that sometimes he appeared very hard, and he was compromised so many different interactions that we can see.
Certainly, I totally agree. That's why we have to read the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita. But I agree, there's a time for all of this. I mean, one of the greatest examples for me of humility is Arjuna on the battlefield. Arjuna agrees to fight. He surrenders to Krishna. That's humility. And what's the manifestation of that humility? He kills 16 million people. Now, it's not your classic humble act that you take up a bow and just start shooting people, but that was humility. And so I think the issue of humility is nuanced, and it's an issue that we have to explore. So it doesn't mean... We regard it as soft, but it means courageous. It means strength. You have more strength to be humble. It takes more to be humble than it does to do anything else. I mean, how many people can remember an Irish freedom fighter? So we got our freedom from the British Empire before India. You remember a single Irish? Anyone know a single Irish freedom fighter? Can anyone remember an Indian freedom fighter? Just one? Gandhi. How come everyone knows Gandhi? Everyone in the world. I just gave a series of lectures. What's that?
Bose.
Yeah, you're just trying to be awkward, though. But not everyone knows Bose, but everyone knows Gandhi for a specific reason. That Gandhi tried to do it by non-violent means. He took the soft approach, and everyone thought he was mad, and he actually succeeded. And it shows the strength of principle and the strength of humility. He actually used some of these principles. So it's interesting. He's a politician. Yeah, he didn't claim to be a saint. He was an observant Hindu, but he was a politician. What to speak if you use it in any other powerful context? So what's the power of Gandhi? Is Martin Luther King claims descent? He's in the lineage of Gandhi. Nelson Mandela, Barack Obama, they all claim to be disciples of Gandhi. If you're a Western politician, you nearly have to claim to be a disciple of Gandhi, even if you're not. And it seems to me Barack Obama accepted a Nobel Peace Prize for something he didn't do. The Gandhian act would have been to refuse it. He's not the Mahatma. He's not the great soul. But everyone is so impressed by this person's example. Example being the issue. And the example was and I've just been at a series of classes in Holland with professors of a research hospital in three classes. And in every single one, I used Gandhi as an example to start off my class. And I asked, what do you know about Gandhi? And everyone came up with integrity, honesty, humility, nonviolence. Everyone came up with the same things. They were absolutely impressed with this person. And they didn't even know much about him in terms of where he got his ideas from. So I would suggest that if we look at any aspect of Lord Chaitanya, we will find humility shining through, manifesting in different ways, and complicated and nuanced as it is. But if we examine it, I think we'll find humility at the base, without doubt. When he stands and becomes firm with someone, there's humility behind it. He's not doing it to the detriment, he's doing it out of love. That's exactly the case. It's very interesting, though, that in the few cases where Lord Chaitanya actually preaches to someone, you know, from a philosophical point of view, he mainly chants Hare Krishna congregationally, but every now and then he stops and he preaches to someone. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Prakashananda Saraswati, his mode of preaching is extraordinary again. And he respects that these people know more than him. That's his starting point. His starting point is, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you tell me. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya just lays it on him, thick, for days and days and days. And Lord Chaitanya just listens. Now, I find very difficult to follow that example. Because if some evangelical Christian comes up to me and starts laying it on thick, you know, after 10 seconds, I'm just saying, oh, okay. You know? You haven't heard what I have to say. I mean, I'm on him. The Lord Chaitanya just listened. And this is not only humble, this is wise. Because he let Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya get everything out. He was humble. He respected him as an elder. So he felt fully respected so he could say everything he had to say. He said absolutely everything he had to say until he had nothing else to say. So he was ready to hear. And Lord Chaitanya had heard all of his philosophy, so he was ready to speak. He could actually address exactly to the core, and he did it. And he nailed it in a couple of sentences, practically. Very wise. You know, very humble, very respectful. extraordinary example. Because, I mean, when I approach someone, if I see an evangelical Christian coming, my automatic response is not respect. You know, I don't respect him because I think he's wrong. And that's not respectful and it's not humble. I haven't even heard what he has to say. He could be actually a very nice person and he could be practicing some form of bhakti. Because, you know, to say prayer to God without motive is bhakti, it's vandanam. It's part of our process. And I haven't heard that. I've already judged him, and I'm just standing there with my big stick of the Bhagavad Gita, ready to smash him. And he's coming with his big stick of the Bible, ready to smash me. And we, as people, we don't meet. We just meet with our big sticks meet. Bhagavad Gita says, no, the Bible says, boom, 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 boom. So it's not, there isn't a personal interaction. There's no humility. There's no virtue attached to the exchange. It's a very dreary exchange. So I'm just suggesting there are other ways to approach it. I totally agree with what you say, and I think humility is very nuanced and for us very complicated because we don't practice it very often. But I think we should wheel it out every now and then. Worship it. It's like there's a joke about the Irish that we worship truth so much we would hardly ever use it. I think sometimes in this kind of we worship humility so much we would hardly ever use it. Okay, out of respect for Manohar Das and various other Vaishnavas, we will end here. Srila Prabhupada ki. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Jai.